broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. This week, former prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi returns to the show. Mr. Bugliosi was with us a few months ago after the publication of his gigantic and marvelous book on the Kennedy assassination, Reclaiming History, and you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org for that interview. And today we discuss his new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. This book is the most scathing indictment of a sitting president ever written by someone who is not a crackpot. And Mr. Bugliosi is anything but a crackpot. The respected author of several books and the man who won a conviction against Charles Manson for murder, even though it's well known that Manson was not present at the killings for which he was convicted. In this book, Mr. Bugliosi calls the president a spoiled, callous brat who became president only because his father's good name, and a son of a bitch. In his new book, Mr. Bugliosi also attacks Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, as well as the New York Times, Ted Koppel, Dennis Miller, Yvonne Lendl, and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Mr. Bugliosi, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, Gary, it's always great to be interviewed by you, and I appreciate the voice you're giving me here. I don't know if you know the story behind the story here, that the book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, is literally being blacklisted by the national media. When I say blacklisted, there's no conspiracy here. It's just that each member of the establishment has turned me down nationally. I've never had difficulty ever getting a book published. That's something that doesn't even enter my mind. I've had three books, got up to number one in the New York Times. But for this one, I couldn't get a publisher, and I had to fly back east. I was turned down by several big publishers. They seemed to be sympathetic to what I was saying, and they recognized the marketability of the book, but they'd say things to me like, Mr. Bugliosi, are you sure you want to publish this book? And one put it just in black and white, too hot to handle. But finally, I got a publisher. The next step, Gary, is to get audio for a book. And I'll get around, this is all summing up why I'm so happy that you're giving me a voice here.
You bet.
The next step is audio. That was an automatic for me. I never paid any attention to it. My agent would just tell me that we're with so-and-so. Like with Reclaiming History, we were with Simon & Schuster. But this time I get a call from him. No audio company in America is willing to do the audio on the book. So we had to get the British Broadcasting Company to do the audio, and they have an audio now. There's a documentary based on my book for the big screen. The producers couldn't raise one penny here in America, so the money had to come in from Canada. The mainstream media, as I indicated, for the first time in my career, I've had many books. I always start out in New York City on a morning show or some equivalent show. I do several national shows, and I start traveling around the country. I have yet to get on one national television show. Everyone is terrified of the subject matter.
Even though President Bush is really on his last legs now?
Yeah. The right wing really has transformed this nation into a nation of fear. When you have someone like Mario Cuomo, as I point out in the acknowledgement section, a very decent and honorable man, being sufficiently intimidated to say, I respect Rush Limbaugh, an uncommonly reprehensible individual. That's just one example among so many, as I said it, of the shadow of fear that has now descended upon this once great nation. But what I was saying is that although I'm being blacklisted, the book is selling very, very well by word of mouth. And this coming Sunday, it'll be number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. So I think it's going to go up almost assuredly.
Now that you've been on From the Bookshelf, it'll shoot to the top of the bestseller
list. Yeah, it's doing extremely well. And of course, number 14 is not normally where I find myself, but it still is a bestseller, and the publishers are ecstatic about it. They say, Mr. Bugliosi, this is astonishing that you're number 14 when you've gotten absolutely no national coverage.
Has the book been reviewed in any national?
No, but it's a little early for that.
Okay.
But Gary, thank you so much for letting me reach more Americans on this very, very serious story, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, obviously it's an important book, and I know that you are very serious about it, so let's talk about it a little bit. Now, son of a bitch, is that a legal term?
If I can use that word on the air, I'll tell you how that happened. That's in the section prologue the prosecution. The date is August the 13th, 2005, and I've already established that George Bush, throughout this entire war, has been smiling, enjoying himself, having fun, running, bicycling, joking with friends, slapping backs, dancing and swiveling his hips like Elvis Presley to blaring music, eating his hot dogs and blueberry pie, nearly always seeming to be in the best of good spirits. So this one day was August 13, 2005, and he's at the ranch on a five-week summer vacation. And this is right in the middle of some of the greatest or the worst fighting and atrocities over there, terrible mutilations of bodies, beheadings, etc., and the survivors of the victims just, you know, crying out hysterically and uncontrollably over the deaths of their children, their parents, their sisters, and their brothers. And I'm talking about Iraqi and American survivors, many times only receiving back dismembered parts and limbs of their loved ones, and finding no way, obviously, to cope with the unspeakable horror of it all. Right in the midst of all that, the author of all this horror, George Bush, he has a hearty breakfast at the ranch, and then he tells the assembled members of the media what his plans are for the rest of the day. And he said, I'm going to have lunch with Secretary of State Rice. She had been elevated from National Security Advisor. Take a little nap. I'm reading an Elmore Leonard book right now. Knock off a little more Elmore Leonard this afternoon. Go fishing with my man Barney. That's Bush's dog. Have a light dinner, then head for the ball game. Then he said, so it's a perfect day. Now, when I heard those words, I can utter the word B-I-T-C-H without spelling it.
Go right ahead. Okay.
When I heard those words, I said to myself, no, you son of a bitch, you're not going to have a perfect day. Or I should say, you're not going to have another perfect day for as long as you live if I have anything to say about it, because I'm going to put a thought in your mind that you're going to take with you to your grave. That's the least I can do for the thousands of American soldiers who have come back from your war in a box or a jar of ashes, and the thousands upon thousands of innocent Iraqi men, women, children, and babies who have died horrible deaths. What I was talking about when I said put a thought in his mind, I'm talking about the proposed prosecution of Bush for murder and the fact that there's no statute of limitations for the crime of murder. Gary, I don't know you personally, but just by talking to you, I sense that you would be the same as I, and I can tell you that if I ever killed a human being, even one person, accidentally, like in a car accident, I would never have another perfect day as long as I live. And here's this guy who's responsible for over 100,000 deaths, and he's talking about having a perfect day. In December of 2007, he said, I'm feeling pretty good about life. Now, Gary, even if George Bush was only responsible for making a mistake, if the only thing he did was make an innocent mistake in going to war in Iraq, not murder, as I firmly believe, with all of the death and horror and suffering he has caused, what type of a monstrous individual is it, Gary, who could be happy with his life? But that's not how I would convict him in a court of law. This book gets into all types of things, like Bush couldn't possibly be any worse in fighting terrorism. But the heart of the book, of course, is the evidence. Before you go to court, you've got to have evidence ready to present to the jury. And I present an enormous amount of extremely incriminating evidence, some evidence so strong that all by itself, you give me a yellow pad in 100 hours, I think I could convict them on it alone, like the Manning memo. But we'll get into that. You ask the questions, and hopefully we'll get into some of the evidence in the case.
All right. Well, I'll set you up for that right now by asking you this. You know, why should Bush be prosecuted for a war in Iraq any more than Woodrow Wilson for World War I, or McKinley for the Spanish-American War, or certainly President Johnson, who's, you know, now we know that the Tonkin Gulf incident was possibly just as fake as any weapons of mass destruction or whatever.
Okay. Well, number one, there's no evidence whatsoever that I know of, no credible evidence that any of these other presidents took this nation to war on a lie under false pretenses. Let me correct you on one thing, the Gulf of Tonkin thing. That has been proven now to have not been staged at all. The book you got to read on that is Taking Charge by Michael Besloff, a historian. And the transcript of the telephone conversations between LBJ and members of his staff, like Secretary of Defense McNamara, at the very time the alleged attack on the Maddox was taking place, and that would have been, August 4th, I think, 1967. From the moment that LBJ hears about the alleged attack through his decision on how to resolve it, it's very, very clear from the transcript of the telephone conversations that he was responding to new information in a evolving situation not of his making. LBJ did everything possible to avoid going to war in Vietnam. He was a very reluctant warrior. And as recently now as 2005, a historian for the National Security Agency has ascertained that the NSA originally made a mistake when they said that there was an attack on the Maddox. They quickly discerned thereafter that they had made the mistake, and they tried to cover up and act like there had been an attack. And this is coming from the NSA now, a historian, looking at all the documents. And he said not only didn't LBJ and LBJ administration know about this, but even high officers at the NSA, it was done at a local level. There's no credible evidence at all. There's just this allegation out there that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was staged. By the way, I talk about this in an endnote. I'm not dropping names because I don't do that, but I think this is an interesting one. Johnny Carson said to me before he died, he said, Vince, I read all your endnotes. I don't write typical endnotes. Some of my endnotes, like in Reclaiming History, go on for 50, 60 pages with 30 footnotes. But the difference, of course, is that what evidence do we have these other presidents took the nation to war under false pretenses? None. The main issue at the trial against Bush, if there were a trial, and let's jump over legal technicalities, which I do not do in my book, of course. I go into depth on all the legal aspects of this.
Right. You said, just for our listeners, you said that not only could he be tried in a federal court, but that each state could try him if they so
right.
desired.
But I'm talking about malice aforethought, express malice, implied malice, vicarious liability, all of those things.
Right.
If you respect, as I think you do, my knowledge of the criminal law, if Bush were brought to trial, the central overriding issue would simply be this. Did he or did he not take this nation to war in self-defense, his so-called preemptive strike? His allegation that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country because of his weapons of mass destruction, so he said we have to strike first in self-defense. If he could prove that, that's a legal justification for what he did. If the prosecutor can prove, and we have overwhelming evidence of this, if he could prove that Bush took this nation to war under false pretenses, then all of the killings of American soldiers in Iraq would become unlawful killings and therefore murder. So that would be the key issue at the trial.
To establish that Bush knew he was lying, that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, right. Let me just give you one example of an extremely powerful piece of evidence. And the book is full of this evidence. What's the date? January 31st, 2003. Less than 2 months before Bush invaded Iraq. George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have a meeting in the Oval Office with six of their top aides, including Bush's National Security Advisor at the time, Condoleezza Rice, and Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, David Manning. Now, this is less than 2 months before Bush went to war saying that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, so we had to strike first in self-defense. After the meeting, Manning wrote a five-page memo for Blair stamped, quote, extremely sensitive, unquote, in which he summarized for Blair, who was present at the meeting, what was said at the meeting. And he said that Tony Blair and George Bush expressed their doubts that any weapons of mass destruction would ever be found in Iraq. But much, much worse than that, he said that Bush was so, not Blair, but he said Bush was so upset over the fact that the UN inspectors had failed to find any weapons of mass destruction that he talked about three possible ways to, quote, provoke a confrontation with Hussein, one of which, he said, was to fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq, falsely painted in United Nations colors. And Bush said if Hussein fires on the aircraft, that will be a violation of UN resolutions and a justification for war. So here we have George Bush telling American citizens and the world that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. And yet behind closed doors, this small man is talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. Now, Gary, the last person in the world someone acting in self-defense would try to provoke is the person he's in deathly fear of, the person who's about to attack him. If Bush actually believed, and this would be his defense at the trial, if he actually believed that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, the thought of provoking Hussein into a war would never, ever, ever have entered his mind. What I'm telling you, Gary, is this just one piece of evidence alone. How is this guy going to get around it? Is he going to say at the trial, if he were tried, I didn't say it? First place, the Bush administration has never questioned the authenticity of this document. If he says, I didn't say it, you put Manning on the stand. He said, of course he said it. You think he's going to commit perjury and say, no, I just wrote that, he didn't say it? Well, the question that would be, well, then, Mr. Manning, if he didn't say it, why did you put it in a memo that you gave to, of all people, your boss who was present at the meeting? It wouldn't work. How's Bush going to get around it? This is a guy who's talking about provoke Hussein into a war at the very time that he's telling America that this guy is an imminent threat to the security of this country. I've got a lot of other evidence, too, but this is just one strong piece of evidence.
We're talking with Vincent Bugliosi, and his new book is called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Well, okay, so you have all the evidence. Well, what about a motive? Why would President Bush want to take us to war?
Well, that's a good question that you've asked, Gary, and it's a question that I cannot answer. I can tell you what he said. I can tell you the motive he gave. Everyone knows that. He said Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, so he was an imminent threat. We had to strike first in self-defense. But there are many people that do not believe that was his main motive. I should tell you that many lay people believe that motive is an element of the corpus delicti of a crime, but it is not. A prosecutor never has to prove a motive. It's always good to prove a motive, because that's circumstantial evidence of guilt, just like the absence of motive is circumstantial evidence of innocence, but it's not an element of the crime. It does not have to be proven. I've put people on death row, Gary, without knowing for sure why they did it. All I knew is that they were the ones who put that person in his or her grave, and that there was no legal justification for their doing so. But I can tell you what his express motive was, but what his real motive was, if that was not his real motive, I don't know. All I know is that whatever his motive was, it was no good.
Well, in the book, you not only attack President Bush's motives for going to war, but you actually show some skepticism about his love of country and his religious beliefs. How do you know what's going on in his mind?
Well, I don't, and that's not how I would convict him. You're talking about stuff from the prologue to the prosecution chapter. That's not evidence of guilt, but this book is not just confined to evidence of Bush's guilt. It's also a discussion of who this monstrous individual is. And the first thing you mentioned before the God thing, I forget what you
his
said.
His love of country. You say he doesn't love this country.
Well, yeah, I don't think he hates the country, but I don't think he loves it. And I offer several pieces of evidence that go in that direction. The first piece, of course, is that when it was his time to fight, he ran like hell in the opposite direction. Like all of these right-wingers, almost all of them, Cheney, Rove, Bush, Limbaugh, they ran like hell in the opposite direction. Now, they have no hesitancy waving the flag and shedding the blood of other people's children. So he didn't fight for his country. His father did. John Kerry did. JFK. Many, many did. He did not. And it wasn't because he was opposed to the war. But when you really love your country, you fight for it. And he did not fight when it was his generation's time to fight. I'll give you one other piece of evidence, and I'd like to get into more of the evidence, although I'll answer any question you have. But these things that we're talking about here now, it's a very important chapter. It includes the photo section of the book. There are people now looking at those photos and right. writing in that the photo section itself is worth the price of the book. But if you were to go to your neighbor who knows nothing about national affairs, international affairs, is not particularly bright, and basically I'm describing George Bush, not an inquisitive person, and you said to him, for whatever reason, don't ask me why, you're the president of the United States. What do you think that person would do, knowing that he doesn't know anything? Well, if he was an ordinary person who loved his country, there's only one answer to that question, Gary. He would knock himself out 7 days a week, becoming as knowledgeable as he humanly possibly could, to learn as much about all the issues facing this country so that he'll be able to perform in an admirable way that will be beneficial to the citizens of this country. That's an automatic. There is no other alternative. You don't know anything, and you're the president, and your decisions affect the destiny of millions of people, you're going to want to know what's going on.
President Bush does not do that?
No, the absolute opposite of that. There's a fellow by the name of, he's in the book, Martin Noller, I think is his name. He covers the White House for CBS Radio, and I can call him at any time and find out the number of days that Bush has been on vacation. And in the book, as of January the 1st, 2008, which would be left not quite 7 years into his presidency, during that period of time, before I gave you the time that he has spent away from the White House, my wife and I work 7 days a week, took 3 days off, and I'm a total cipher, a total nonentity. We took 3 days off to celebrate our 50th anniversary to go to the desert. You know how many days George Bush took off in less than 7 years, according to Martin Noller, who keeps track of the president because he follows the president around? 908 days the ranch in Texas or Kennebunkport or Camp David. Far, far, far more than any other president in American history. That, to me, is a bit of circumstantial evidence that this man does not love this country. I'm not saying he hates it. I'm saying he does not love it. But again, Gary, that's not the heart of this book. The heart of this book is his guilt and how to bring this guy to trial. But I want people to know about him. There are people reading this book now, because they've already gotten back to me. It's, you know, it's a one- or two-night read, not like Reclaiming History that takes people months and months and months to read. They're getting back to me, and they're saying things like this, that I didn't think it was humanly possible for me to have more contempt for George Bush than I already had. But to my surprise, they're saying when they read the book, their contempt for Bush rises dramatically, in part because of the things he has said and the way he's conducting himself throughout the entire war. I'm in a great mood, you know, I'm having a perfect day, and Laura and I are having the time of our lives. Can you imagine FDR or Truman or LBJ or Nixon during their respective wars saying stuff like that? So they're getting this hatred for Bush even greater than they already had. I've had a couple people who have high blood pressure say they can't read more than 5 or 6 pages of my book without putting it down because they get so angry. Sorry, Gary. Go ahead.
No, that's all right. But President Roosevelt, he was known for his cleverness and his big smile. And JFK, he was quite a wit. Yeah, so why is it so different for Bush to be a happy-go-lucky fellow?
Okay. JFK was not president during a time of war, so let's eliminate him from the thing. FDR, we're not talking about a smile. A smile is a gotcha thing. Of course he's going to smile. In my book, there's one photo in there that the publisher put in that should not have put in. I don't want gotcha smiles in there. You look at those photos, Gary. Those are not gotcha smiles. He's having the time of his life. These are fun smiles. He's enjoying himself very, very, very much. They're not just a smile. But who has any evidence that Roosevelt was having the time of his life during the Second World War? It aged him beyond his years. There's no comparison. Can't compare it.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the other lie. You mentioned the weapons of mass destruction.
Yes.
But what about the
The second lie was a very, very important lie, but to me not as much as the first lie, which is that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. The second lie that Bush told the American people, Gary, was his unmistakable innuendo and implication that Hussein was involved with al-Qaeda in 9/11, which we know, of course, was not true. At the time of 9/11, Gary, only 3% of Americans believed that Hussein was involved in 9/11. Yet we know that it wasn't long at all before the vast majority of Americans came to believe that Hussein was involved in 9/11. Now, if it wasn't Bush and his people, Gary, who were responsible for this suddenly widespread misconception, then who was it? You? Me? Danny DeVito? One way Bush convinced the American people of this lie is that he kept telling the American people that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, and he'd invariably couple his allegation with these constant references to 9/11, sometimes in the very same sentence. So it was normal and understandable for the American people, you know, they're interested in how their hometown football or basketball team is doing, and they just pick up these subliminal messages. They're not concentrating on all the words. They can't believe that their president is up to no good. It was understandable for them to infer from the juxtaposition of these two things that Hussein must have been involved in 9/11 because Bush would talk about 9/11 and then talk about Hussein being an imminent threat. Additionally, Bush flat out lied to the American people by alleging that Saddam Hussein had a close relationship with al-Qaeda, which we of course know was not the truth. For instance, he told Americans that Hussein had, quote, terrorist connections, unquote, with al-Qaeda, that Iraq trained al-Qaeda in bomb-making and the use of poisons and deadly gases, and that when you're talking about the war on terror, he said you cannot distinguish between Hussein and al-Qaeda. Now, if the American people, Gary, believed these false assertions, as the vast majority did, it would not take an Olympian leap of logic on their part to conclude that Hussein most likely joined with al-Qaeda on 9/11. All of this evidence would be presented at the trial. But that's the second lie he told. But the main lie is by telling the American people that Hussein was an imminent threat to security of this country. And if we didn't strike first, you know, then we were not acting in self-defense, and we had to act in self-defense.
We're talking with Vincent Bugliosi, and his new book is called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. What are the chances, Mr. Bugliosi, that Bush will be held accountable in any way for his lies?
Another excellent question, Gary. You always do your homework. Being candid with you, I don't think there's a high probability that he will end up in an American courtroom, but I do believe very strongly that there's a substantial possibility that he will actually end up being prosecuted for murder in an American courtroom. And the main reason I say that is because of the great number of prosecutors that I've established jurisdiction for in my book. Bush can be prosecuted under both federal and state law for two crimes, conspiracy to commit murder and murder. On a federal level, the prosecutor would be the Attorney General in Washington, D.C., acting through his Department of Justice. Now, there are 93 U.S. attorneys, federal U.S. attorneys around the country, but it is completely unlikely that they would bring any action against Bush without the consent of their boss in Washington, D.C. So, realistically, on a federal level, we're only talking about one prosecutor, the Attorney General in Washington, D.C. But on a state level, I've established jurisdiction for the Attorney General in each of the 50 states, plus the hundreds of district attorneys and counties within those states to prosecute George Bush for the murder of any soldier or soldiers from their state or county who died in Iraq fighting George Bush's war. Now, with all of those prosecutors out there, and we're going to be reaching out to them in about 4 or 5 days with a cover letter from me and also a copy of the book, with all those prosecutors out there, Gary, and the tremendous amount of extremely incriminating evidence against Bush, I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that at least one prosecutor in America is courageous enough, and maybe many, many more, to say, wait a while, this is the United States of America. And in America, no man is above the law. The evidence of Bush's guilt is clear, so I'm going to go after him and bring about justice for the American people. In this cover letter, I'm volunteering my services, obviously, to do whatever I can to help the prosecutor, and that would range all the way from being a consultant up to special appointment as a special prosecutor.
You would love it. You'd like to be in court.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a brilliant book, and it's called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, and the author is Vincent Bugliosi. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Gary, thanks to me. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.